Formula One is entering a new era. Cars are smaller, batteries are bigger, there are fully sustainable fuels, overtake buttons, active aerodynamics, and new manufacturers joining the grid. The biggest reset in years, the kind that can reshuffle the entire competitive order overnight. Some teams will get it right, and some will get it very, very wrong. One way or another, the power balance has shifted, and a new chapter of Formula One has begun. This is the Sporting Almanac Podcast. It's back.
It is back.
The long and lonesome winter is over.
Yeah, I was going to say the love-hate relationship with Formula One is emerging, as you say, from the depths of the winter season.
I think this is the most optimistic I've felt about a Formula One season for a while, I would say. I think last year was a nice palate cleanser, I think. Someone other than Mr. Verstappen winning the title was nice. And it was close all the way to the end, which is all you can really hope for. And a few different people won races. Not as many as you'd like, but enough to make it interesting every week. So, yeah.
Ready for this one?
Actually, I think there was only four people who won races. I think it was just George Russell and then the top three. But, you know, could be worse.
I mean, am I a cynic or a skeptic? Because I hear what you're saying, but they're really good at marketing. They always have been. So, like, there's a lot of fanfare and there's a lot of hype and it does seem exciting. But this is the thing they're good at.
Like, yeah.
I want to see it translate into, like, weekly entertainment, not some of the drivel that gets served up. We'll get into it.
I think that's very fair enough.
We'll get into it.
I have no idea what this season's going to be like. The regulation changes have been colossal. And the difference in the car performance and the difference in the way the cars work now compared to last season is huge. The testing was very up and down for a few teams. Some teams came out of it looking good, some teams came out of it looking bad. But it's testing, it's pre-season testing. Who knows who's sandbagging, who knows who's pushed their car to the limit yet, who knows what reliability in races is going to be like, who knows what it's going to be like week after week after week with the turnover, who's going to develop the car quicker, who's going to embrace these new rules quicker. I wouldn't like to put a bet on who's going to win the title this year, even though there are a few early favourites emerging.
Yeah, I agree with you that there are perhaps more unknowns and variables at play. And I think the thing that genuinely might be interesting and might actually shake things up and add to the drama and the sporting drama, not the politically motivated drama that they concoct every now and again.
But, which will be there regardless, yeah.
Oh, yeah, of course. Like, you know, that's absolutely
unavoidable.
Guaranteed, isn't it, when it comes to Formula One? That reliability point, I think, is the persuasive one. Because the rule changes are so radical, and there have been reliability issues in testing.
Yeah.
Even for some of the teams that seem to be perhaps at the forefront, for raw pace or what have you. That could really throw things into the mix. Because it's been a very long time since reliability was a genuine issue in Formula One. Because these are some smart cats and they find solutions quickly.
Yeah, I mean, the amount of races last season where all 20 cars finished or there was only crashes that put people out of the races as opposed to failures, part failures, whatever it might be. I can't remember. When was the last time Max Verstappen retired with an engine failure or a gearbox going or...
It would
anything
have
probably
been Bahrain a few years ago when Red Bull had a double DNF. Do you remember?
Maybe. There probably has been odd instances in the meantime, but just using him as an example, it just doesn't happen anymore. These cars are so reliable, and yeah, one good thing that kicking up the rules can do is add a bit of unpredictability into the mix, certainly in the early races, so be interesting to see what happens.
I agree, because the reliability, like, The point you're really making there is maybe we can cite an example where someone suffered a reliability issue on one occasion.
Yeah.
But there is the potential for it to be a consistent issue, at least in the first half of the season.
Yes, which you don't really see because, as you correctly point out, they are very, very quick with their solutions.
Yeah. And they may well be this time. They may well be this time. We're giving it the big one.
They may well be this time,
and
yeah.
Everyone's going to be fine. But yeah, maybe the rule changes is a good place to start, actually, because they are radical. The biggest ever seen.
They're huge. The feedback you're getting from the drivers about this is very, very mixed. And you do worry that the positive feedback you're getting tends to be from some of the more inexperienced and younger drivers. So it might be political in nature rather than them being honest, because the ones who've come out and said negative things, and I'll come to their comments after we explain what the rule changes are, but the ones who are saying negative things tends to be the Lewis Hamiltons, the Max Verstappens, Lando Norris, Fernando Alonso, people with clout who know that their position
is safe,
is not going to be affected by whatever they say, because they've got a lot of world championships between them.
Yeah.
14, I think, between those four.
And to be fair, they have a wider spectrum of experience, so they have had exposure to a larger range of regulations and different types of cars, so they are best placed to assess.
Well, yeah, I mean, Alonso and Hamilton, certainly, yeah.
Yeah,
I've seen it all. Seen V12s all the way down to these hybrid V6s and power units and 50-50 electricity and power balance, as it is now.
Yeah.
Seen it all.
Well, that's the big one, isn't it? I mean,
it's huge, yeah.
You'll know the technicalities better than me, but the power unit, the chassis, the tyres and the fuel are all new.
Yeah.
And there are quite significant changes in respect of like aerodynamics. Drag reduction system's gone. So yeah. Anyway, where do we want to start? What do you want to explain to people in a digestible way?
Let's start with a positive, which is something people have been calling for a while, although probably one. It's done to a bigger extent than has been done. The cars are smaller.
Yes.
They're about 20 centimeters shorter and about 10 centimeters narrower, which means they're lighter. So they're about 5% lighter than they used to be. I think the cap is down to 764 kilograms now,
yeah,
from 800. So
a lot more,
about a 5% reduction.
Maneuverability.
Yeah, more nippy. You can throw it into the corner more, which, to be fair, drivers have been feeding back that is positive. There's also the tyres are narrower than they were previously, which means there's a smaller surface area on the road, which means there's less mechanical grip from the tyres, which means you lose a bit of, obviously, grip there, and there is less downforce as well. So overall, the cars are slightly lighter, but less downforce, less grip, probably going to be slower. In fact, they're definitely going to be slower than last year for various reasons. But it's a good place to start, making the car smaller, and that would be a good trend to continue. Probably the problem is they've got so many gadgets inside them that it's been difficult to keep them small and keep them light in recent years, but they have taken some things out this year. The most notable thing they've taken out is the MGUH, which is the motor generator unit heat, I believe.
Yeah.
Which is basically an energy management system that used to, in previous years, convert heat from the exhaust into energy. And that was used to also control the turbo, which was particularly useful in powering up the turbo before startups. Mm-hmm. That's been removed now. So the only thing which is now generating
kinetic
electricity.
Energy. Yeah.
Yes, is the MGUK, which is MGU kinetic, the motor generator unit kinetic. And that converts basically energy from braking into stored energy. And that is the only thing now which is generating energy. So now you've got this situation where you don't have two means of generating energy. So you're either generating or you're using energy. You can't like generate and use at the same time.
Yeah.
And I mean, there's other things as well,
but that's important, that bit's important, because I think you're about to come on to this.
Yes.
Is that half the engine is run by electrical energy.
Yes.
And so charging up the battery through your kinetic energy is a very important tool for the
So the engines are still the same basic engines last year. They're still V6 turbo hybrids. They have much bigger batteries now. The cars have basically moved from being, last season it was about 84% internal combustion to 16% electrical, and now they're pretty much smack on 50-50.
Mm.
So 50% coming from the ICU, the internal combustion unit, and 50% coming from the batteries. So there's a massive, huge emphasis on power management this season, which again is getting a lot of criticism from the drivers, who being drivers, they just want to go fast.
It's fast, yeah.
And it's like playing a computer game while you're trying to drive a 200 miles an hour.
And so they were saying that the biggest sort of change that you're likely to see is in cornering, because like you said about the grip, and that is potentially exciting, but then it's also unlikely that the drivers are going to go flat out through the corners, because what they're going to do is drive through the corners at a higher gear than they would ordinarily want to, because it revs the engine higher, which restores the kinetic energy and charges the battery.
So that's a thing called super clipping, which is a word which is sort of making the rounds at the moment, because that you've only got the MGUK now to generate electricity. They're able to do it while driving at full throttle by this method known as super clipping. Basically, they sacrifice speed in order to get battery power later on. And this can have a huge effect on speed. There's a section in the Bahrain track that is being driven, I think, 21 miles an hour slower, something like that. Around 20 miles per hour slower.
Towards the back end of the lap, where it's like a fast, sweeping couple of right-handers all one after the other. And they used to love it, and now they're just sort of coasting through there.
Yeah, it sounds counterintuitive to be going through it 20 miles an hour slower, but the energy you gain from doing that gives you a faster lap on the whole than it would be to go through flat out and then not have the battery power stored.
And
it led to...
Oh, go on. No, go.
I was going to say, it led to one of the best quotes of the drivers talking about this, which was from Fernando Alonso, where he basically said, "We're going so slowly that the team chef could be driving the car."
Yeah, I saw that in the testing. Yeah, when he was in the journalist paddock thing, whatever it is, pen.
Yeah.
No, I was going to say, the relevance of, you know, what you're talking about and like storing that energy in order to go faster is directly relevant to the system that's replaced DRS. And like, that's kind of the point. Like, instead of DRS, you now basically get a burst of electrical energy to speed your car up. And only obviously if you're within a second of the car in front as you go through the specific time traps on the, or detection points on the track. But
yeah, just one detection point now.
Yeah, which likely to be at the end of the laps, isn't it, normally?
I think it is. If you're within 1 second at the detection point for the entirety of the lap, you get overtake mode, as it's called, as long as you stay within 1 second of them. I think if they break the 1 second gap, you then lose it again. But if you are within 1 second and stay within 1 second, you can use overtake mode, which basically is very simple. It's just a boost of electrical energy, which allows the driver to theoretically overtake, and then with the lighter cars and the less aerodynamics at play, less ground effect and things like that, the idea is you can race closer, so you can get closer to the car in front than you could previously, and then this overtake mode would make it a bit more of a natural racing overtake rather than DRS, which was very, very artificial. Now, you could argue, obviously, this is quite artificial as well. Whether or not it leads to better racing, people have doubts. I have my doubts. We will have to see in Australia and beyond. Actually, Australia is not the best track for overtaking.
Yeah,
there's better ones coming up.
Quite narrow, isn't it? Because it's effectively a street circuit. Yeah,
yeah.
No, like I agree with the thing that's very interesting about like the way in which it's sort of trying to influence the overtaking exercise is that you mentioned ground effect there, and like obviously people slipstream, and then the cars under the old system, it took them a while to fix it, but they used to porpoise bounce basically.
Yeah.
And that's ground effect because of the way the bottom of the car was designed aerodynamically. But that would disrupt the air, and it would make it much harder to follow in the slipstream, and hence the reason why you need a DRS to speed you up. If you don't have ground effect anymore and you do have an electrical burst of energy, the theory is that with a more stable slipstream, you should be able to race closer and overtake, not more easily, but perhaps with smaller cars in a more exciting way.
Yeah, and that's ideal. I mean, everyone harks back to the olden days. The cars were lighter, smaller. They could get closer. They could race closer. There wasn't any of the overtaking malarkey like DRS or overtake mode back then, and yet overtakes still happened. I mean, depends how far you go back, because I remember watching this sport in the 2000s and people struggling to overtake all over the place, but the cars were narrower, so at least there was a bit of a chance somewhere like Monaco or indeed in Melbourne, where it is quite a narrow track. But yeah, well, we'll see how it works.
We'll see how it works. I mean, one of the early successes, one of the things it has worked well for already, was that the original idea of the big rule change was to attract more manufacturers into F1. And it's been very successful because Audi, General Motors and Ford have all entered F1 because of the new rules, because they're arguably cheaper. That's the big thing.
Yeah.
And Honda reversed its decision to quit. Not that that's going particularly well for Honda currently, but they nonetheless...
It is a feeling of deja vu, really. Honda in a change of rules era struggling, but nevertheless.
Yeah. But they were supposed to
go. And Fernando Alonso being the one being punished by it. It's all very familiar.
Well, they were with Red Bull, weren't they? And fell out with them.
Yeah.
And then obviously now joined Aston Martin,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we'll come into sort of the driver. Well, not there's been many driver changes, but the new driver, the new teams in a bit.
Well, we'll just talk about them all.
Couple more technical things before we move on. You're chomping at the bit, I can see.
I just want to get into the meat and drink of it.
I have to mention the race start procedure because this is very different. I mentioned before the MGUH, the motor generator unit heat that used to spin the turbo. You could use it to spin the turbo, get the turbo going before the start. That's been removed now. So the problem teams were having, and the reason they've changed the start procedure slightly, is the turbo basically wasn't getting up to speed quickly enough in some cars. Ferrari weren't quite having the same problem other people were. So the rule changes might not disadvantage Ferrari, but minimize the advantage Ferrari have.
Well, they've been flying off the line on practice stuff.
Yeah, there's been a huge differential in speed off the start, which, to be fair, is quite dangerous. So basically, the new procedure is a blue light comes on,
but
they've got 5 seconds to rev their engine, and then the countdown starts. So, yeah.
I mean, that is exciting. I don't like the idea that when you get discrepancies, they try and level it, because isn't that the point? Like, I know it is a dangerous sport, but let's not make it sterile here. Like, these are the best of the best of the best. Like,
would you be saying that if Red Bull were the team with the advantage, though?
Of course I would.
And not Lewis Hamilton's team.
That'd be so damn preposterous. Like, I exercise my right for bias as a fan, but as a lawmaker, like, you know, let's be serious. No, I am obviously excited through the prism of being a Lewis Hamilton / Ferrari fan, generally speaking, just because Lewis Hamilton's there. Otherwise, I wouldn't be. But I don't like the politics where but all the teams lobby that haven't found a solution to the problem. They all lobby to disadvantage the team that has found the solution. And it happens every single time. I mean, Mercedes...
Every time.
...are subject to a lot of scrutiny because of some part of their design of their internal combustion engine or something.
There was a capacity limit, but the capacity limit was set at cold temperature, and they basically worked out the... However they designed it, it expanded at hot temperature. So technically, it was the correct size within the rules. But then when the temperature heated up, as obviously the inside of a Formula One car does, then it expanded and allowed them a greater capacity and to get more power out of it, which is, I would say, a smart interpretation of the rules. But it was the questions being asked, and because other teams didn't think of it, then obviously... You get people moaning, and you end up with this sort of boy who cries wolf situation where it happens so often that no one listens to any legitimate points if they're made, because it's all lost in this sea of moaning and trying to gain some sort of advantage in the situation. So
it's framed as what it is. It's framed as cheating, isn't it, essentially, by the teams that don't have the skill set. They all try to make out that they knew that they could have done it but didn't do it because for moral reasons. And
there's no decision.
Yeah,
McLaren, Ferrari, Red Bull, Mercedes, all the top teams have never made a decision based on morality.
No, I know.
In their life, none of them have.
All about winning.
All about winning. And just win, baby.
Talking of winning, then, unless you have any more rules that you want to update anyone on who's interested in the upcoming Formula One season, do you want to talk about the teams and the drivers?
I mean, the only other things are there's other boost mode, basically a way of deploying your energy as well. I mean, it's not like active aerodynamics, which is sort of similar to DRS, where it happens automatically, where your rear wing opens basically on the straight. You have like a straight mode and then a corner mode. Yeah, they're very clever, the cars. They're very intelligent, and I'm sure all this being well thought out, and hopefully it'll lead to some good racing. But yeah, it's, I mean... if you want to know more about this, people have written very in-depth articles who are far smarter than I am. So look into it. But I can summarize it by telling you what the drivers have said. Max Verstappen described it as Formula E on steroids, which is, I think, a fair description. Lando said it was not the purest form of racing, which is diplomatic, of course. Already mentioned Fernando Alonso's less diplomatic statement about the chef could drive the car. And then Lewis described it as all being very ridiculously complex, basically. Although he did say that he liked the smaller cars.
He said they were fun.
He finds them fun.
Yeah, he said they were fun. So, well, yeah, I guess we'll see. The proof will be in the pudding.
Yeah, some safety risks as well have been pointed out, I should say. Andrea Stella has pointed out that because cars are lifting and coasting towards the end of straights, you get speed discrepancies being created, and basically the risk of cars rear-ending other cars is quite high. But I imagine it's kind of a mistake that someone does once.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, pay attention. Don't be Lance Stroll.
Well, the problem is Lance Stroll is one of the 22 drivers on the grid, so someone has to be Lance Stroll.
That's probably genuinely where that sentiment's coming from. Like, there is this guy that's not going to be able to cope with this.
So why is he in the team then? Well, let me answer that question.
Well,
have you heard of Lawrence Stroll?
I was going to... I've listed off all the teams in alphabetical order and Aston are second. So...
They are?
Hold your horses.
Go on then, teams, let's do it.
Let's do it. Because there's 11 teams this year, which is a change. One extra.
Yeah, yeah. First time since 2016.
There are name changes. 11
on the grid. Yeah, there are.
Sauber has become Audi. And there are new driver lineups, although not many.
No, 19 out of the 20 drivers who finished Abu Dhabi Grand Prix last season are on the grid this season. The only one who isn't?
Oh, that's a great question. Should I know that? Is it really obvious?
Yeah, I mean, which is the only team that ever chops and changes their drivers?
Racing Bulls. They've got the rookie, Yuki.
Yuki, who is now test driver for Red Bull and for Racing Bulls.
Oh, well,
yeah, he's the only driver.
Yeah, that's a shame.
Yeah, funnily enough, they ditch Honda engines and then the Japanese driver is out on his ass.
Yeah.
May or may not be a coincidence. The fact that he also got 33 points to Max's 400 and whatever last season probably didn't do him much help either.
Yeah, maybe.
That is a cursed second seat for Red Bull.
Yeah, it is. They're embarrassing the way they conduct themselves. We'll come to them. First alphabetically, are French fellows at Alpine. Pierre Gasly. Yeah,
not Alpine Renault anymore.
No.
They're not powered by Renault engines, even though Alpine is a Renault brand. Renault are out of the engine market.
Yeah, they left.
Alpine Mercedes now.
Yeah, which, you know, may well be a masterstroke given how fast the Mercedes is looking. Yeah, Gasly, the alien, affectionately known as the alien between you and I, because he looks like an alien.
Love him.
Yeah, probably one of, if not your favourite driver, maybe.
I'd say low-key my favourite driver. My favourite who's not affected by the team he drives for.
Yes.
Or probably a bit of history in that I love the Williams drivers. I will always love any Williams drivers. But that is because they're Williams drivers. I didn't love Carlos Sainz until he joined Williams. Not that I didn't like him, but didn't love him. And Alex Albon, well.
Yeah, he's hard. He's
can't
hard
to, not love him.
He's hard to hate. But yeah, Gasly's with Franco Colapinto, who had a very good little sort of stint when he stepped in for somebody, but didn't do so well last year.
Yeah, he replaced Jack Doohan early in the season.
Yeah, after six races, but he actually didn't score a point in the 18 Grand Prix that he did drive, and Gasly collected all of Alpine's constructor points last year.
Yeah, he's a good driver, Gasly.
Yeah, he is. Good driver. Yeah. I think it's his fourth year there, is it?
It must be about that, yeah.
Yeah, so... I don't know. Alpine are a little bit of a dark horse, aren't they? Had a stinker last year. They're not normally that bad.
They got it completely wrong last year. And then, as teams often do, they abandoned all hope, any attempt to catch up last year, except that they were going to come last and focused on 2026. And all told, it sounds like they've got a reasonable car. Mid-table, obviously. But
yeah, mid-table
fodder. Gasly is mid-price, like in the top 10 for the bookies. Where they think he's going to finish. So
yeah, okay. Yeah,
looks positive.
Well, he's the sort of talent that if he has a good car under him could have a few interesting races.
Yeah,
a
podium or two maybe.
Yeah,
similar to Carlos Sainz last year.
Yes. So that's Alpine. You know, take them or leave them. They're pretty inoffensive. But next does divide opinion.
It does. Yeah.
Aston Martin.
Certainly their driver choice do. Or at least one of their driver choices. You can't really complain too much about two-time world champion, albeit a man who's fast approaching his 50s, I think, now.
He's 45 in July, Fernando Alonso. Yeah, I mean, what can you say about Alonso, really? He's like he's one of the best.
I think he's a record holder for most Grand Prix now. I mean, he must be, surely.
For starts, yeah, I think you're right.
Yeah.
Yeah, he finished 10th last year, went on a pretty decent point-scoring run when last season was going through Europe. Yeah. His teammate, though.
Yeah.
Lance Stroll.
Yeah. Similar surname, actually, to the team owner.
Yeah.
Weird. Lawrence Stroll's the team owner.
That
yeah.
is strange. Stranger. That's very unusual. Yeah. Particularly when he went 0-24 in qualifying against his teammate.
His two-time world title-winning teammate, who, again, is in his mid-40s. But, you know, he's had his moments, to be honest. Okay, let me defend Lance Stroll.
This is novel.
He's had a couple of really good performances. One in the rain, I seem to remember. Was it Turkey a few years ago, maybe? When they were there last? When Hamilton won? Was it then?
He was on pole, wasn't he, for one of those races?
Maybe. He's had a pole position. So, you know, he's not... Obviously, he's driving in Formula 1. He can drive a car very well. It's all just relative, and he's always going to... It's going to be very hard for him to shake the Nepo baby tag, especially when he keeps doing dumb stuff.
Yes. I just don't think he is deserving of a drive, or B, a drive in a car or a team with the prestige and status of Aston Martin, and... like being alongside somebody who is clearly there on merit, you know, even if he is a bit old and hanging on.
I mean, there's one more person we have to mention with Aston Martin, their new team principal.
Adrian Newey.
Yeah, Adrian Newey, who is, for anyone who doesn't know, there is no bigger name in the world of designing Formula One cars ever than Adrian Newey. He's
the godfather.
Consistently jumped from team to, yeah, literally, jumped from team to team and brought success with him wherever he's gone for 30 years now. And... he's now team principal at Aston Martin. He's been paid a lot of money to be there. So the question we ask ourselves or each other quite often is, can they claim to be a serious team investing all this money in the best in the business and a two-time world champion as well, while still retaining Lance Stroll in the second seat?
Well, I think that's a very legitimate question to be asking, because everybody else selects their drivers on pure merit and aspiration.
Yeah, like how fast they are. Generally speaking.
Yeah, and that does not seem to be the criteria at Aston Martin. They seem to be spending an awful lot of money on everything except their second seat.
I think it's a long-term project, Aston Martin. I don't think they're expecting to be winning races this year. You never know what will happen, especially with Alonso around. I don't think they're expecting to be winning races, but surely a year or two down the line, that is what they'll be expecting. And they've been courting Max for so long and probably got their eyes on other people too. But I presume that will be to replace Alonso when Alonso retires. I think they're going to keep Stroll in that second seat forever.
Probably.
I mean, they haven't got rid of him yet.
Well, this is it. And like, if you want a little taster of Newey's dominance, I don't have the precise numbers, but I'm having a quick look back at the champs here since the 80s. And it's basically Lewis Hamilton, Nico Rosberg, Jenson Button, maybe Kimi.
Are these not...
That have won in non-Adrian Newey design cars.
Yeah.
All of the Schumacher wins, all of the Vettel wins, all of the Verstappen wins.
Not the Schumacher. He wasn't at Ferrari. He was at McLaren then.
Oh, yeah, sorry. It was Mika Häkkinen, wasn't it, that had him?
It was Mika and then Lewis at the back end. He was still at McLaren then. So.
Yeah. Was he at McLaren in 2008 with Hamilton? I don't think he was he?
It was around that time that he went from McLaren to Red Bull. I would have to check what the actual date was. It was around then.
Having a look at Adrian Newey's career as we speak.
Maybe it was a little earlier.
67 years of age.
Yeah, 2006. He went to Red Bull. So no, it wasn't for the Hamilton ones, but it was for the Mika Häkkinen ones. And that was a very, very good car.
And then before that, it was Williams, like Damon Hill and...
Yeah.
Ayrton Senna, actually.
One of the most dominant race cars for a number of years, that one.
Yeah.
Other than Benetton. Broke them, but that was largely because they had Michael Schumacher behind the wheel.
Yeah, that's it. It's like there's very few people that have won titles not in Adrian Newey cars since the late 80s.
If Ayrton Senna hadn't died in 1994, I think that Williams would have won every single title all the way through to 1997, which is actually when he left and joined McLaren.
And then they started winning.
And chances are, to be honest, if Senna had lived, he'd probably have taken Senna with him. They'd probably gone together.
Yeah.
Senna's triumphant return to McLaren. Senna would be about 10-time world champion now.
Yeah. But that's Aston. They're really struggling, though, because Newey wasn't allowed to start because of the contractual arrangements that he had with Red Bull.
Yeah, big old gardening leave.
So he started work like quite late, and it is showing.
The Honda engine is not helping, as we mentioned.
Yeah, it keeps breaking down. So, you know, kind of need to get to the end.
I would say, from what I've heard, from the rumours, from what the bookies think, putting it all together, best chance they've got this season would be maybe an Alonso podium. Maybe.
That's
a long-term project.
That feels optimistic. But you're right, they're maybe not targeting this year, and nor should they with Adrian Newey at their disposal. Next team, the new team, or one of the new teams, but not a new team, an old team that's rebranded as a new team. Audi.
Yeah, with the same driver lineup that Sauber had last year.
Yeah.
A good driver lineup, I would say, actually.
Yes,
Nico Hülkenberg and Gabriel Bortoleto.
Yes.
I think they're both good. I think Hülkenberg is a reliable old hand. He could easily be a number two driver in a better team, but happy being the number one driver, Audi. It will be interesting how they do. I don't think they're going to be any different, particularly from Sauber last season, this season, but with the backing, Audi engines as well. Be interesting to see how they do in the long term.
They have the model that you were saying that you would have anticipated Aston Martin adopting. So Hülkenberg's 38. He's at the twilight of his career. One of the great romantic stories last year, where he got his first podium after 239 race starts at the British Grand Prix of all places.
I cannot say how big a deal that was. I was buzzing for the man.
Yeah, it was nice.
And I was very, very annoyed. The two McLaren drivers on the podium with him basically ignored him on the podium.
Yeah, that's...
You hate to see it.
That's naughty. Because if you want to know what 239 race starts looks like, it looks like 15 years.
It's literally like more than a fifth of all the Grand Prix ever.
That's a sensational stat.
Nearly a quarter.
So, yes, he's waited a long time. Whereas at the other end of the spectrum, Bortoleto is only 21. He was a rookie last year. He did very well. Finished sixth, I think, is his highest finish at Hungary.
Yeah, sounds about right.
So, yeah. Like, they have the model of a team that's trying to progress. A youngster who they are presumably have a lot of faith in his talent and want to grow around him. And then an old head to try and sort of steer the team and you know, help them develop in the short term.
Yeah, it's going to be a long-term project. I mean, obviously, they're brand new into the sport as an engine manufacturer as well. There's a steep learning curve for them, although they've clearly got the backing and clearly got the expertise. They're massive, one of the biggest car companies in the world, it goes without saying. So it'll be interesting to see where they are in 5 years' time, by which point maybe Bortoleto will have, you know, become their number one driver. Maybe they'll brought in someone younger. Maybe they'll have invested in a number one driver of their own. Maybe they'll spend some money and get a top driver in. Who knows?
But it will be exciting to see Audi's name on the grid and an Audi car.
It will be.
And I did like their livery.
Yes, it looks good. And they've got a good basis from last season with Sauber. So it will be
starting from scratch.
An easier transition than, for example,
the next
Adelaide
team.
Yeah.
Who are new.
I was just doing the alphabet in my head there of all the teams. I was like, it will be Cadillac next. Let's lead into that.
Yeah, very nicely
it's
done.
Gonna,
smooth.
Yeah. I suspect it's going to be a really difficult season for these two. They're two very experienced and very talented drivers. I would say one slightly more talented than the other, but we know our opinions of Sergio Perez.
One is the greatest number two man ever, arguably.
Valtteri Bottas is a great driver. He's a top driver. He probably didn't deserve to spend a year out of the sport, and I'm glad he's back.
He's also
going to be really difficult for them.
Sensational on Instagram.
Yes.
Valtteri Bottas is a funny man. He markets himself very well. He has a very dry sense of humour. I think everybody is probably pleased that he's back in the sport. Bit of personality.
Yeah. If you're relatively new to Formula One and you just want to follow someone interesting, he's a Finnish driver, but he is an Australian. I don't know if it's a wife or girlfriend. I think it's a girlfriend, but he is basically an adopted Australian. So he has he's got an Australian haircut. He's got a mullet and a mustache and walks around in Speedos all the time for no apparent reason, just because he can. And yeah.
Takes a mick out of himself.
Very dry sense of humour.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like he did his helmet reveal where he was basically showing all the outside of his helmet, all the details, and it just zoomed out and he's just naked in a swimming pool for no reason whatsoever.
Yeah, he's good value.
Love it.
But he's all, like, he spent a lot of time at Mercedes, 10 yeah. Grand Prix wins, 20 pole positions, yeah. 67 podiums in his career so far, which started at Williams as well, another one of your favorite teams who we'll come to in 2013. Yeah. 36 years old, so he's an old hand. Yeah, are we good to see him? And then obviously you've already said he's alongside Perez. Yeah, well, mate, I don't want to be too harsh on Sergio Perez. You take the lead.
I think he's a good driver. I do. I think he's a good driver. I just don't think he's, I don't know. I don't think he's a great driver.
Six victories.
Maybe he'll prove me wrong.
Six victories, three poles, 39 podiums, 35 years of age, backed tremendously in the financially by a series of Mexican companies, which probably did his no harm in securing his return to Formula One. And I'm not being cynical about that. Like that's a factor.
He's good enough. He's good enough to be on the grid.
Yeah,
regardless.
He's good enough to be on the grid. Yeah, and obviously you've lost his seat at Red Bull. I think it's that Red Bull performances.
That cursed second seat.
Yeah, cursed second seat, but I think it was those Red Bull performances where I thought that he was perhaps given a much softer ride relative to others that have attempted to drive there.
Yeah, but he was in that Red Bull when it was so much better than any other car on the grid. Therefore, he could afford to be, you know, a second behind Max and still coming second overall. The second that gap tightened, and McLaren particularly, and other teams as well, start to catch up and bridge that gap, it wasn't that he was coming third or fourth or fifth. It's he was coming eighth or ninth or tenth and not contributing to Max's title battles and helping him out. And that's obviously
that's when you get
ultimately
done. Yeah,
where you get done. But I mean, Tsunoda did worse than him. Other drivers have done worse than him in that seat as well. So it's not that I think he's a bad driver. I just don't think he's necessarily
an excellent one. Yeah, but like, yeah, and I understand why they brought him back. Oh, sorry, my Alexa interrupted me. I do understand why you would bring him back. Like, they've clearly gone for pure experience. Like, get these guys to help us understand the cars, understand the you know, like how they drive, help us improve iteratively over the course of the season, and don't have to rely, or rather, perhaps, don't have to concern themselves with unreliability in like performance and unpredictability that might be attributable to a youngster, a rookie or something.
It's a sensible driver lineup, and I did say I would have liked to see Danny Ric in one of those seats, Daniel Ricciardo, but
yeah,
I think that would have been the more fun pairing with Bottas, obviously, but probably not the sensible pairing. I think this is a very sensible pairing.
Yes. And again, a long-term project for Cadillac. Then they're new, and were they owned by GM?
Yes, yes. General Motors.
So they are rich,
American, another American team.
Yeah. So part of the expansion of F1 and another big name. So it makes it a little bit more fun, a little bit more exciting. On the optics. So yeah, I guess that moves us on quite nicely from the very new to the very old, the one of the greats. One of the legends of the sport, the prancing horse.
I mean, there is no Formula One without Ferrari, and there is no Ferrari without Formula One.
Yeah.
It is. They are Formula One.
I think ultimately. That's right. Yeah, they are the brand, basically. Yeah. And they have a sensational driver lineup.
Yes.
If they can put a good car under these chaps, please.
It's not just about putting a good car under them as well. The Ferrari team strategy.
Assemble a good pit crew, please.
Competent.
Assemble a strategist, please.
Just so much that needs to be done differently. And you could see, it was palpable how frustrated Lewis Hamilton was again last season. And yes, clearly mentally he wasn't in the best place. And yes, he was underperforming by his standards. He didn't really suit the car particularly. I could tell Charles clearly suited it more and was happier in it. But I don't think Charles was very happy. I mean, they weren't in a position to win races last year.
Yeah.
Charles has won a lot of races in the past with Ferrari and is a very talented young driver who deserves to have a top car put under him. If it is a top car this year and there is signs it may be, whether or not as a race car it's as good as the Mercedes or the Red Bull, I don't know. But there are signs that maybe it's a race winning car at least. It would be very interesting to see how the two teammates do against each other because they're both supremely talented and Lewis is obviously ridiculously experienced.
And they're different ends of... that's it. There are different stages of their career. Lewis is 40s, obviously a 7-time, asterisk 8-time champ. He doesn't have anything to prove. He's got the most wins of all time, most podiums of all time. He's a god. He's sort of staying in the show, maybe for one last hurrah. Whereas Charles is, I think it's probably fair to say that if he gets a good car at 28, this is the point at which you're sort of expecting him to really threaten for a title. Because he had that one shot against, was it against Max a few years ago? And he just
Yeah, he was there or thereabouts.
Like sort of made a few mistakes whilst leading in races and things like that. Obviously a lot maturer now, a lot more experience under the belt.
Yeah.
7 podiums last year, all of Ferrari's podiums. Lewis didn't podium.
Yeah, yeah. It very impressive, actually. Like, I was very impressed with him last year in what was clearly not a very good car.
Yeah.
Relatively, by Ferrari standards.
Yeah, for sure. Like, well, Ferrari, if they're not competing for podiums every race and or threatening, you know, title challenges, then it's a disappointing season.
And they hear about it.
No, they hear about it. They change their team principal. Everyone goes. Like, there's a lot of reform that takes place when
they'll be talking. There'll be questions asked in Parliament about it.
Yeah,
in the Italian Parliament.
That's a great way of putting it. This is basically the Italian Formula One team.
Yeah, it's huge. Yeah. It's so ingrained in culture, in so many cultures. Obviously, Formula One culture, Italian culture. It is bigger than the sport. Ferrari are bigger than the sport. Transcend it.
Transcend, indeed. What are the odds for these guys? What are the bookies saying? How do they view the Ferrari chances?
Positively. I mean, Charles is third favourite for the driver's title. Lewis is fourth favourite.
Oh, interesting.
And odds fairly similar between Charles and Max. Not too much between them. Lewis is a little bit longer, but you'd expect that after his season last season. But I wouldn't bet against Lewis picking up some race wins if that car is a race winning car, ultimately.
Never bet against a goat.
Yeah.
So yeah. Let's see how it goes. Obviously, you and I will be hoping for a stellar Ferrari season.
I mean, if either of them win the title, I'll be happy. I'm a big fan of Charles.
next team on the roster is, well, for a while at least, was probably everyone's second team, Haas.
Yeah.
When they had Gunther.
Gunther, yeah. They're a bit less likeable now.
They are.
Obviously, Drive to Survive and Haas went hand in hand. And Gunther Steiner was just an absolute box office on that. But
great personality.
But he's gone now, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Driver lineups, probably a bit less fun than it used to be, but I would say a pretty solid driver lineup, nevertheless.
Yes. I mean,
Ocon and Behrmann.
Yeah. Ollie Behrmann is very talented. I suspect Ferrari have got one eye on him.
I think so. I think he may replace Lewis in the long run.
And he's got a bit of comparing him to the greats is so dangerous because he's done nothing. But he's kind of like he's a bit like Alain Prost, like very safe, like very like, you know, he's not as exciting. He's not swashbuckling, but he's very, very good, very methodical, very
probably
consistent.
A good teammate for Scholl.
Yeah, all in all. I just think I mean I might be completely wrong about his actual driving style, but I mean, like, how he presents and sort of how he races just strikes me as a guy that, like, is aware of what needs to be done and is very good at executing it and doesn't try to be overly flash.
He really impressed me last season. I was surprised at how consistent he was, particularly for a period towards the end of the season. He was really good for 5 or 6 races. Towards the back end of the season, he was just picking up points after points after points. Fourth place finish. He was flirting with a podium in Mexico. So yeah, really impressed with him.
Yeah, he came sixth in Zandvoort as well. After starting in the pit lane. Yeah, like he's good. He's good. And Esteban Ocon will always have a place in my heart for crashing into Max Verstappen when he was being unlapped. Absolute legend. And getting in a fight with him on the scale.
I was going to say, and giving zero dams about it as well.
Yeah, he did not care. He's quite a divisive bloke, Ocon. I think he fell out with Gasly at Alpine, didn't he? They kept crashing into each other, which is why one of them got the chop. But yeah.
I think there's a real way you could look at Ocon's career and see a lot of missed opportunities. I think he was being courted big time by Mercedes at one point. I think Toto Wolff's
his manager.
Yeah. He's still his manager, yeah. So there was always that link there, and I think maybe he could have done more with his career. Although there is still time, obviously.
He's only 29, but like you're right, he's probably missed the boat for that really big move. Unless, you know, well, Formula One's a weird sport. Unless a door opens somewhere for him in very peculiar circumstances, I don't think he'll be at like the big four, but can still have a very good career. So Haas will be mid-table fodder, won't they? I mean, the bookies, what are they saying about these guys? Got any interest?
Mid-table fodder.
Yeah.
I think you put it nicely.
Mid-table fodder.
Probably similar to where they were last season.
So there's
points definitely on the table, but not challenging for podiums, you would expect, unless there's exceptional circumstances. And Haas have podium finishes in the past in crazy circumstances. So, and Ocon has a race win, of course.
Yes.
In Hungary 2021.
Yeah, he does. Well, okay, let's start talking about the big hitters, the big boys, starting with the champs, McLaren, who were dominant last year, in the constructors. Obviously, the drivers was a little bit more exciting, but a crazy, crazy good driver lineup. Oscar Piastri and Lando are reigning current world champion.
Yeah, even though I think he's the second best driver at McLaren, I still think that, but he won the title.
Yeah.
I'm not sure I'll ever win another one, but who cares? He's won a title.
He's won one. And also, like, me and you spoke about it before. Like, it's just lovely that it happened to one of the good guys. Like, he's a nice...
Yeah, he's a nice
bloke. Nice lad, Lando Norris. And, like, he never changed who he was during that title fight. Like, he remained polite. He didn't try and be, like, some sort of, like, killer or, you know, like, some sort of, like, Terminator winner. Because that's just not who he is. He, like, retained his personality. And, yeah, it was just lovely when he said thank you to his mum and dad. That was like the first thing he said over the radio when he won, which I thought, thought was beautiful stuff. Whereas the other guy is a bit of a Terminator, is a cool hand, is unflappable.
Well, I mean, he flapped a couple of times towards the end of last season, but I mean, he's also a young driver in what is third Formula One season, challenging for a world title. That is to be expected. He ends up coming third, Oscar Piastri. I think he's very good. I think he's very good. I think he's the kind of guy that, yeah, pressure. Clearly, he's not quite got the level of cool head that maybe some of the top drivers in this sport have had in the past when they're chasing their rookie title. He let it go maybe a little bit. He's the kind of guy, I think, if he does win one, he could win a lot.
Mm.
He could. Once that sort of hoodoo is out of the way, I think he's very, very good. Not Max Verstappen good. Not Brian Lewis good, but very, very good.
Yeah, yeah. He's certainly one of the more talented young drivers on the grid who may be sort of taking the baton, so to speak, when some of the big boys start to retire. But I mean, look, Lando's going for he's trying to be the first McLaren driver since the aforementioned Mika Hakkinen to go back to back.
Yeah,
which would be pretty cool. And I think Oscar, when was the last Aussie champ? Has there been one? Jack Brabham.
Yeah, Alan Jones, Jack Brabham as well. Alan Jones was 1980. That would probably be the last one, unless I'm forgetting anyone.
Yeah.
Is it 1980? Around 1980.
Yeah, a long time ago. And obviously, he's starting at home, which is fun for him.
As it should be. I like the first Grand Prix being in Australia. Feels right.
Yeah, it does feel right. I feel safe when the F1 starts in Australia. It means that, you know, world order is as it should be, even when other things cause you to question it. But yeah, McLaren are one of those ones where we don't really know this year, do we? We're not sure. They're going to be good,
no,
but how good?
The bookies put them longer up. Basically, they reckon McLaren will be the fourth best team. I don't imagine that will mean they will finish fourth in the Constructors' Championship, because chances are Red Bull will only have one driver winning all their points, although we'll come to them. I do think Hadjell's quite good. They put them below Ferrari and Mercedes, but not far below.
Not far.
And I think the thing about this season is, it is unpredictable. Where teams start might not be where they finish. McLaren clearly spent a lot of money, their money last year, to secure those championships, as you'd expect. Maybe that means they start a little bit behind, but the setup is so good. I can see them catching up, even if they do start a little bit behind. So they'll win races this year.
Yeah.
Both of them probably will.
Yeah, and they'll be in their famous papaya, obviously.
Of course.
So that brings us to the pre-season favourites.
Yeah.
The Mercedes-Benz. George Russell, the pre-season favourite for the driver's title, I think.
Yeah.
And Kimi Antonelli, who is obviously a talented youngster. Yeah, look, I mean, What do you say about Mercedes? Like, when this juggernaut gets a rolling?
The last time we had such a huge change in the regulations, Mercedes promptly won the next 7 titles, yeah. I think, on the bounce at that point. So it is fair to say that the expectations are there. They've done it before. They've got a ridiculously good setup in that team. Their early signs are good. They've got a very good driver in George Russell leading the team. They've got a good young number two in Kimi Antonelli, who will be interesting to see how he does this year. I think maybe could have done a little bit more last year, got a podium, but yeah, maybe could have got a few more.
Couple of podiums in Brazil and Las Vegas. But he finished 7th.
Took a while, yeah.
7th overall, and like you say, maybe a couple of missed opportunities in there as well. Whereas like George had a very impressive year, actually.
George was excellent, yeah.
Yeah.
Because then they were comfortably the third best team.
Yeah, and he came 4th. So, you know, only behind. He was the best of the rest after Verstappen and the two McLaren drivers. 27 now, so like bang in the prime.
Yeah.
5th year at the Silver Arrows. So, you know, well established.
Yeah. Yeah, clearly the team leader. Obviously not in Lewis's shadow anymore. Got a young teammate who's not getting the results that he is. So he will get the backing of the team. He is favourite. He's favourite by not by a mile, but, you know, not quite odds on. But he is comfortably favourite with most most people putting numbers out. So
there's going to be people that don't like Toto Wolff and don't like Mercedes because of the Hamilton era of dominance, who are going to be having sort of like New England Patriots kind of like flashbacks and trauma at the prospect of this this machine firing up, because like it's German, it's Terminator stuff, it's efficient, it is ruthless, and when Toto wants to wear a polo, what do you call it, a high neck, he looks like a Bond villain.
He genuinely does. He knows what he's doing as well.
He's an absolute legend, Toto Wolff.
I mean, God, he's an extraordinarily successful man.
Yeah.
Like, he's a billionaire. Like, he is. He knows what he's doing.
Yeah, he does.
They will know what they're doing. And if they're good at the beginning of the season, I suspect they will develop, keep getting better. It'll be very hard for other teams to catch them up. It will take, in terms of the driver's title, if they go good car, they get a sort of roll on at the beginning of the season. I think they'll probably have a really good race car as well, because they always have a good race car.
Mm.
Even when they're not necessarily the quickest on the grid, they always can do long stints very well and manage their tyres very well. I think there's only really probably, unless the Ferrari is very good, it'll be a two-horse race for the title, just because the other horse in that race is mercurial talent.
The guy that we're probably about to talk about right now, because the next team is Red Bull.
Yeah.
And yeah, well, it's no secret. It's Max Verstappen. That's who you're talking about. He is paired with Isaac Hadjar, who you obviously mentioned earlier, you know, is talented. But yeah, he does take on the poison chalice.
Yeah. the amount of drivers who have done well with whatever the second team is called at the time, Racing Bulls now, previously AlphaTauri, previously Toro Rosso, the amount of drivers who've done well there and then stepped up to the Red Bull team. I mean, other than Vettel and Verstappen, everyone else has just gone downhill from that point. Perez, they brought in from Force India, it was Force India at that point. Everyone who's gone up through the system and been promoted into that second seat, we're talking Gasly, Lawson, Tsunoda, obviously, other people that I'm forgetting, probably because they were only in the seat for about 4 races and then got ditched.
Who else? Albon, obviously.
And Ricardo was the last one who
Ricardo
matched Max, but Max was very young at that point. Max Verstappen is so good, and the team is built around him. The car is built around him. It will be interesting to see if the car is as good as Max this year. It certainly signs are from testing that it is a good car, and if it is a good car, then Max will drive it to 120% of its capabilities, because he is extremely good.
Well, let's put it this way. I know there's a little bit of divide and conquer from the McLarens, but Max won the most races last year.
Yeah.
Which is wild, because that McLaren was absolutely rapid, and Red Bull went through a very turbulent period of the season with like the whole Horner thing and not being able to win a race and going backwards a little bit. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, as you say, the McLaren never stamped their authority on either of their drivers. They never said, this is Lando's season, you back him up, Oscar. Because if they had, Lando would have won 10 or 11 races and he would have won the title easily. or indeed if one of them was considerably worse than the other, they'd run away with it. Or indeed, if they just didn't crash into each other as much as they did, they probably would have run away with it. So it was always a matter of their own doing. As Max correctly pointed out towards the end of last season, they should have run away with it, and they didn't because of decisions they made and bad choices they made. And Max hung in there, and he lost the title by 2 points.
Yeah.
He's very good.
It's annoying.
Not very likable, but no, he's very good.
He's not my kind of guy, I don't think. But there is no denying that when it comes to driving automobiles, he is in the echelons, the high echelons.
Yeah.
Because he's
I mean, he's an all-timer. I mean, he's a four-time world champion. Of course he's an all-timer.
He's already an all-timer, yeah. Like, if he wins another one, he's going to be sort of entering podium territory of, like, number of victories.
Yeah. So, yeah, five is third currently.
Yeah.
It's the 2-2-1-7 and then Fangio on five.
Fangio, exactly. No, I mean,
the 2-1-7 being Hamilton and Schumacher.
The goat and the goat.
Yeah. I'm not gonna decide between them.
No, for me it's Lewis just, but that's for debate for another day. Max is certainly entering that conversation. The more world titles and the more wins he accrues, it's probably a bit premature. I also think that it has to be acknowledged that he's won with a Newey car.
Yeah.
But, you know, you can only drive what's under you, so let's not be too difficult in that regard, or unfair. But yeah, like, we can Red Bull, second, third favourites. Max, second favourite, I imagine, just because of the car, not because of the talent.
Yeah, and again, he didn't really have a teammate last year backing him up. He got 421 points. Yuki got 33 points. That probably is a record, I imagine. I've not checked, but I imagine that's a record for biggest discrepancy in points between teammates. It's all about the drivers' championship for them. We've not even talked about Isaac Hadjar yet. I think we probably should mention the...
Got
I hope he does
last
well.
Year. He got a podium.
Yeah, he's a really, really good driver.
Yeah.
I think he is very talented. He seems to have the right mindset. He doesn't seem to be fazed by anything. He's come straight up from Formula 2, smashed Formula 1 to the extent you can in a racing bull, done really, really well. And his driving style is probably more similar to Max's, you would say, than some of his teammates have been. And given that car is going to be built purely for Max's driving style, that could be a positive too. We'll see what happens, because I think there is quite easily a world where if that car's good and good enough for Max to win the world title, him coming on the podium for the world championship or top four or whatever
is not inconceivable.
Isn't out the question.
Yeah.
But it is a cursed seat, so who knows? He could get 33 points.
It could be gone before the summer.
Six races in, they could have kicked him out. Not that there's really anyone in the...
No, I was just...
I don't think they're going
to... I was just going to say, we're getting to the next team. Like, you've sort of you're so good at these transitions. Racing.
And that was accidental, that one.
The most irrelevant team on the grid is not stacked with anyone that you can envisage taking Isaac's seat anytime soon.
Well, we don't know, because one of them is a child, almost.
Yeah, yeah.
Or barely an adult. He's 18 years old.
The only rookie.
Yeah, Arvid Lindblad. Yeah. British driver of Swedish and Indian origin.
Yeah.
And by all accounts, he's very good. He had some very good moments in Formula 2 last season. Obviously, Red Bull back him because they've just promoted him to the B-team seat, at least.
Yeah, they really rate him.
I'm interested to see how he does.
They really rate him, but he's not the first that they've really rated and then who they've thrown in the garbage heap. So
no, yeah. And Liam Lawson is in the other seat at the Racing Bulls, who was obviously starred last season in the Red Bull seat. And then got ditched for Yuki, not even halfway through the season. Quite, I mean, what, two or three races in, wasn't it? That was crashed him back down to earth.
Yeah.
I don't know if something happened in the background, but I mean, it wasn't based on performances after that time.
It was brutal. It was brutal. Even by Red Bull standards, that was ruthless. Yeah. Well, I don't really care about the Racing Bulls, genuinely. I just think they're irrelevant. I also don't think you should have be allowed second teams.
It is problematic. It going into that last race in Abu Dhabi last season, there was talk about, well, even when like they're passing back markers and the Racing Bulls are making it harder for the McLarens to get past and then just getting out of the way of Max. It stinks. He's got three times as many teammates as everyone else, essentially.
Yeah.
Albeit the Racing Bulls aren't exactly challenging near the front. Well, though, neither was Yuki Tsunoda, so... Fact of it, the Racing Bulls were out racing Yuki Tsunoda most of the season, but that's a different story.
So yeah, let's leave that irrelevant team there. don't even care what the bookies think of them because they will be mid-table. The final team, your favourite team, Williams, and possibly the nicest driver lineup on the grid. Two very lovable guys.
Yeah, I think Carlos Sainz consistently is one of the most popular drivers on social media. Very popular with people of, you know, casual fans and, you know, full-on fans alike. My wife, who sits and watches the Formula One races with me, doesn't really know a huge amount about the sport or care anything, loves Carlos Sainz. She would be delighted every time he gets a podium and would be even more delighted with a race win. Maybe not as happy as I would be with a Williams race win because it's been a long time, but yeah.
Well, look, they got two podiums last year. Sainz got podiums in Azerbaijan and Qatar, but they look like they've really started slowly, haven't they? They got James Vowles in charge.
Yeah.
And he's been quite frank about the fact that they don't think they're going to be too disadvantaged by their slow start, but it doesn't bode well if you're talking about being competitive at the top end of the...
So the thing about Williams is they actually were quite good last season, considering their focus has been on 2026, from everything you hear. It's been on 2026 for a long time. They put a lot of investment into it. They've spent a long time developing their car, and then to be late to the first test because of problems, because of issues that have arisen, was disappointing. That being said, they looked okay when they were testing. Time-wise, I think they were doing pretty well. So I don't necessarily, well, I hope, maybe this is more wishful thinking than anything, that it'll be too big a gap. But I think regardless of that, I think the best they can really hope for is to be in the same position they were in last season, which was top of the midfield.
Yeah, I mean, Albon came eighth and Sainz came ninth, and there were only 9 points between the two of them last year.
Yeah.
They also do. They're good friends, aren't they, these two? They work very well together. They probably display the closest thing resembling to an authentic team, I would say.
James Vowles is a very nice guy as well,
yeah,
which helps with that sort of feeling.
That culture, I guess. But like, what I mean by that is, I maybe the more competitive these guys get and the closer they are to the front, obviously the less likely it is that there's going to be the sort of levels of cooperation that I'm talking about. But to that, what I'm saying is I think if there was a shot for like Sainz to get on the podium or Albon to get on the podium, and the other was sort of, you know, maybe even in the lower end of the points or something, they would work together.
Well, they did in Monaco, didn't they? Mm. They worked quite well together as a team in very, very difficult circumstances, as is often the case at Monaco, where you have to sort of manipulate things a little bit to try and gain advantage. And that's what they did quite well as a pair together, sort of taking it in turns to hold up the field and maximise the points output as best they could in what was a ridiculous race last season in many ways.
Yeah, the two-stop thing. That was crazy.
Yeah.
So yeah, but that finishes the teams and the drivers, the protagonists. We didn't obviously go through the team principals, but we mentioned some of them. It'll be fun. I mean, like, it's hard to know what you're going to get from a Formula One season. I think there have been some great seasons, and there have been some serious duds.
It depends on what you consider a dud, really, because obviously as a Lewis Hamilton fan, we probably don't consider some of the years that other people do consider duds to be duds because Hamilton ran away with it. But anyway, I'm getting in the way. Let's hear some years.
No, I agree. I do agree with you. Like, it is a matter of perspective to a certain extent. But I would concede that the Hamilton dominations, for example, were like not good spectacles. I enjoyed those seasons because the guy who I wanted to win won. But I wouldn't consider it a good season necessarily. Like, not like...
Well, some of them were.
Yeah, I mean, not like...
The Rosberg years, at least they were at each other's throats.
Yes. Yeah. Like, there's definitely some spice occasionally, but like, it wasn't quite like some of the ones that... Well, some of the greatest ones, I don't know. Like, do you want to go? Shall I throw a couple out for you from in reverse order? So, like, from the oldest to newest, or newest to oldest? What would you prefer?
Oldest to newest.
1976, mate.
Yeah.
Hunt Lauda.
Yeah, so iconic it got made into a film.
Yeah.
Which was somewhat accurate if you don't look at the details too much.
And like, but it is like the real life story is that Lauda did have the crash. He did nearly die. He, you know, it was a miracle that he even drove again that season, or maybe even drove again at all.
It's a miracle he survived.
It's a miracle he's alive. Yeah.
He got given the last rites.
Yeah. And they had to literally pump like stuff out of his lungs. It was grim.
Yeah.
Yeah, and obviously James Hunt is just a legend, just a very funny guy, absolute playboy. They couldn't have been more dissimilar, even though they ended up becoming quite good friends.
Yeah.
Like, very different driving styles, very different approaches, and yeah, just watch the movie, man. Rush, if you want to.
Yeah, Rush is a great movie. Again, if you don't look into the details too much, you'll probably enjoy it more. There's little things here and there, which, if you know too much about the season, you start noticing stuff, but that's just me. It was a great season. It went down to the last race. Lauda, famously, the last race was in Japan. It was pouring with rain. Lauda had had his terrible accident at the Nürburgring just a couple of months before, somehow dragged himself back into the car by the Italian Grand Prix. Like, he missed, what, one Grand Prix, two Grand Prix, whatever it was?
Something like that, yeah.
Got himself back in the car with his face bandaged, obviously very, very heavily burnt, barely survived. Doctors were like, you know, you probably won't live. You'll definitely never race again. And like a month and a bit later, 6 weeks later or something like that, he's back in the car for the Italian Grand Prix. Incredible.
Yeah.
But then he pulls out of the last race because of the wet conditions.
Because it was terrible weather.
Yeah, he can't see properly as well because his sweat glands were all messed up because obviously the burns on his face. And basically he made a business decision that this isn't worth risking my life for. There are more important things in life. So he pulls off.
James Hunt has to come third. Yeah.
Yeah, he has to come third to win the title. He does come third, wins the title. But, you know, it doesn't diminish from either of their legend. In fact, it probably adds to it in both cases.
Yeah, for sure. Especially because Hunt then just sails off into the sunset, like one and done.
And Lauda goes and wins two more titles.
And my next one, mate.
The next year.
1984. Not Lauda's next one, but my next season that was a great one. Lauda Prost.
Like, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, was it half a point?
Yeah, the smallest winning margin ever.
Yeah. Yeah, I love that. Obviously, Lauda's a veteran by this point. He'd already retired once, come back in the McLaren. This new up-and-coming teammate it was as well, wasn't he? McLaren teammate.
Mm-hmm.
Or was he in the Renault there? No, it was McLaren, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah, they were both in the McLaren, yeah, I think.
It was 83, he was in the Renault. And nearly won it. Prost nearly won a lot of titles. He won four titles. Narrowly missed out on some of them.
I think this is... I never really realised this, but looking back a little bit and having a look in on this. I think this is what made Prost. Lauda Prosted Prost.
Yeah.
Like, Lauda just finished... He never finished lower than fifth. He won less than Prost, but he was on the podium all the time. He just Prosted Prost.
Experience is so important.
Yeah.
And he was a veteran by that point. I mean, not quite Alonso levels of veteran, because no one would have lived long enough in those days to get to Alonso levels of veteran.
Yeah.
But nevertheless.
I mean, yeah, the next one I put down, like, and throw others into the mix, mate, if you think I'm overlooking them, because I literally was just sort of cherry picking a few to chinwag with you about. But I got 94 here, not because it was like...
Tragic.
Well, it's more like it's like a legendary season rather than like an exciting one. It's just gone down in history for obviously all the wrong reasons.
So much stuff happened in the 1994 season that people often forget because, for good reason, they remember Ayrton Senna's death and Roland Ratzenberger's death the day before as well. The first deaths in Formula One at that point for, I think, 12 years. There was a huge deal. Ratzenberger dying in qualifying and then obviously Senna losing his life.
Yeah.
May the 1st, 1994.
Yeah.
So that's what people remember, but there was
so much controversy after that.
Yeah, Benetton got banned for a couple of races.
Schumacher got disqualified for ignoring a black flag. So he missed two races for ignoring a black flag, which allowed Damon Hill, who was only in the championship mix because Senna died.
Yeah.
Like, to catch Schumacher effectively. And it came down to the last race, and what happened to the last race, Jack?
Well, who was trying an overtake? No, Schumacher went a bit wide on the corner, didn't he? And Damon Hill, probably in hindsight, maybe this is a little prematurely, tried to make the pass on him. And Schumacher, seeing him make the pass, basically crashed into him deliberately. And Schumacher immediately went out, retired. And it looked like Hill was going to go on and win the title. But he'd broken, I think, a wishbone on his
suspension,
his wheels, his suspension, yeah. So had to retire, and it was
Schumacher
ended up winning the title.
And it stank.
It did stink. And I don't know if you're going to do 1997, but he tried the same trick, essentially, on Jacques Villeneuve 3 years later, tried to crash into Villeneuve, send himself out, but Villeneuve carried on. he was winning the race at the time, but he backed off a bit towards the end, let the McLaren through. It was actually Mika Häkkinen's first race win that. Jerez, last race in the 97 season.
Is that one and, where Schumacher broke his leg?
No, no, that was 999, but Schumacher, he just spun out off into the gravel. Obviously, he retired, but Villeneuve finished and got the points he needed to win the title. And then Schumacher got disqualified afterwards from the whole season.
That's, yes, you're right. Because I was muddling those two things up, because Häkkinen had a good run at 99 because he broke his leg, but he got disqualified completely in 97, I remember.
Yeah, so Häkkinen won the title in 99 from Eddie Irvine in the end. It was really close battle with...
Legendary Eddie Irvine.
Ferrari second driver after Schumacher was out with a broken leg, Silverstone crash.
I mean, we've already spoken about two of the other seasons that I've got on my list because they formed a very big part of our Brazilian Grand Prix episode. So if anybody wants to hear all the details of these ones, but 2007, 2008, like the three-way fight in 2007 with the Raikkonen wing by a single point, and then the rise of the GOAT, the penultimate corner of the last lap, and the headbutt, the Ferrari mechanic's headbutt.
Yeah, I mean, do listen to the Brazilian Grand Prix episode because we do go into more details on both. But yeah, I mean, 2007, Hamilton, a rookie, coming out of nowhere, straight on the podium in his first race. A few more podiums, sort of building up third, second, something like that. And then started winning races. And for a while, it looked like he was going to... he should have won the title, really.
Obviously China. But even in that last race, it was only like a gearbox issue or something which dropped him down... Yeah. Dropped him down like several positions, and he couldn't recover from it. Otherwise, he probably would have won. He probably would have won the title. Yeah, obviously 2008. Yeah. Anyone who knows anything about Grand Prix, who is British and is a Lewis Hamilton fan, will know what happened in 2008 because it is stuff of movies. 2012 though just slips under the radar because God,
I really enjoyed the 2012 season.
Season of champs. 2012 might have been the greatest sporting year that's ever happened. Just seven different winners from five different teams in the first seven races. Six world champs on the grid. Schumacher, Alonso, Raikkonen, Hamilton, Button, Vettel. Like, it was incredibly competitive. There was a dramatic final round showdown. Vettel ended up pipping Alonso. But, just crazy.
Alonso couldn't overtake... who was he who couldn't overtake? Who was he who won in Brazil that last race? Jensen, I think.
Oh.
Yeah, so...
A world champ trying to overtake a world champ for the world championship whilst the other world champ wins the world championship.
That sounds very accurate indeed.
And then I didn't want to put it on the list, but I have to put it on the list, I guess, 2021. That would have been one of the greatest seasons ever if it hadn't been fixed at the end. But that ruins it for me.
I mean, am I over it? I don't think I'll ever be over it.
I'm not over it.
The problem with me is, if that had happened, it's not about Lewis Hamilton. I genuinely, and I've said this to you before, I was never as big a Lewis Hamilton fan as you were. It's not that I didn't respect him and not that I didn't appreciate him as a talented driver, but I was a bit fed up of his winning by that point. In fact, I remember being quite, I don't know, not schadenfreude, almost like this is, you know, good from a sporting perspective kind of thing when he locked up in Azerbaijan on that restart and Perez ended up winning the race. I remember thinking, oh, that's quite good. By the end of that season, I was the biggest goddamn Lewis Hamilton fan in the world, present company accepted. Like, he was brilliant that season, despite really coming up against roadblocks left, right, and center.
Just like
being forced off the track, being crashed into, everything you could possibly imagine. And no punishments coming to Max whatsoever.
Just shameless, and then shameless officiating.
Abu Dhabi was the worst thing that I've ever seen live in a sporting event. The worst thing I've ever sat in front of my TV and just felt numb after that. Because within, I knew it was wrong watching it. I didn't know the regulations, but I knew it was wrong. I could tell it was wrong. The second I got out of the regulations and just had a quick glance at it, it became so obvious so quickly that it had been so badly manipulated. And
everyone knew it at the time. Like half the
everyone knew at the time.
Half
and everyone
the drivers
knew since.
On the radios were like, "What?" Like,
yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, so this whole retrofitting exercise that went on afterwards, only to then use the race director as a scapegoat when it was clearly just I'm not having for 1 second, given all the other stewarding and like...
The problem is you don't have to have a direct order for it to be a conspiracy. You don't have to have someone saying, oh, make sure Lewis doesn't win this, or oh, make sure Max win this. You don't have to have that. You just have to have an attitude and pressures being in place and words here and there, people thinking their jobs depend on certain, you know, people being happy and knowing that this would make that person happy. That sort of culture and atmosphere around the place could exist, which could influence a decision like that. It was a travesty, ultimately, and the way it was investigated in inverted commas and dealt with afterwards, it just feels like, it feels very relevant today, because looking at a certain country on the other side of a certain ocean and the way that people in charge are behaving, and there's no ramifications for their actions because they say it's okay, therefore it's okay. And when they come to do an investigation, they're investigating themselves and this, that, and the other. It just feels, it just triggers something in me, which just feels like it's injustice, ultimately.
Yeah, it was. It was an injustice. But look, the good thing is that like Lando still says that Lewis is an 8-time champ in interviews, because he did recently. Yeah, look, we've whinged about it before, and we'll probably whinge about it every time it gets mentioned, because it's just genuinely...
It's the worst thing.
Corruption.
To ever happen.
It was just corruption.
In my lifetime watching this sport, and I've been watching this sport for 30 years now.
So hopefully,
which I think is enough for me to be able to give that opinion.
Yeah, this is it. And hopefully we get more 2012 and less 2021 in terms of like the drama. But if we get the kind of racing that was involved in both those seasons, then obviously this year will be really, really fun.
Yeah, I think it will be. I think it'll be a good year.
Well, fingers crossed.
The worst case scenario is someone runs away with it, and the only person I think would run away with it is George Russell. And, nah, I quite like George Russell.
I quite like George Russell too. I mean, what one of the, like, look, the season is upon us. It is nigh, and it is starting in Melbourne. It's starting in Australia. It's the rightful place on the calendar. 23 different venues have hosted the Australian Grand Prix, but it's been at Albert Park since 1996. Melbourne is a sporting mecca. You and I have paid homage before. It's
many times.
Australians are as big a sports fans as anyone. 131,000 of them turned out last year on race day, nearly 500,000 over the course of the weekend. It's just a fun race because it's not often dominated by one driver or team. There's actually, I think the most to ever win it is Schumacher 4 times, along with Lex Davison, who is an Aussie. Brabham's won it 3.
It's a bit of an unpredictable one because it is so often the season opener. You do sometimes get slightly unexpected results, slightly unexpected winners even. So it's not the most predictable race in the world.
No. Having said that, Lando did win last year.
Yeah.
But
in fact, I think if I'm right in saying it was either, I think it was how they led out the first lap, actually. I don't think it was how they finished, but they led out the first lap, and like the top 6 or 7 in the order at the end of the first lap just turned out to be the actual final championship standings. And it was like, yeah, well, at least they were consistent.
It can happen. It can happen. But look, after this weekend, after Australia, obviously it goes around the world. That's what Formula One does. And there's going to be 2 Spanish Grand Prix this year, which is kind of fun.
Yeah.
Madrid and Barcelona.
El Clásico.
Competing with each other. Barcelona's becoming the Catalonian Grand Prix, and Madrid will be known as the Spanish Grand Prix. Last time we're going to Zandvoort, which is a bit of a shame, given Max's dominance and prominence, and they're very well, they support their people very well, the Dutch.
They do. It's definitely a shame for the fans.
It's not the best
track. No, it's not the best track.
But it is a shame that there won't be a Dutch Grand Prix. And then if you're interested in the sprints, Chinese and Miami Grand Prix get their sprints for a 3rd consecutive year. Canada Zandvoort and Singapore are holding a sprint race for the first time. Canada will be quite
Singapore.
Fun.
Singapore.
Yeah, I know.
Canada will be fun.
And yours truly gets one again for the first time since 2021. And that is good because Silverstone is a boss track.
Silverstone's actually probably as good a track as you can get for a sprint, really. And I don't think sprints are good. I don't think they're a good concept. I think people are more bothered about not damaging their car for the next day than they are about gaining 1 extra point. But yeah.
Yeah.
If you're going to do it anywhere, do it in Silverstone or do it at Sao Paulo.
Yes, for sure. Those are the two that should always have one. Will we get to Bahrain and Saudi Arabia? Who knows? At the moment, they're bombing each other.
Ugh.
So they're supposed to be going there in April. So that's a genuine concern.
Bunch of idiots.
And then I say they're bombing each other. Bahrain and Saudi Arabia are doing nothing wrong. They're just minding their own business.
No, I'm not calling Saudi Arabia and Bahrain a bunch of idiots.
No, I know. Sorry, I said they were bombing each other.
Pete Hegseth and Donald Trump and the rest a bunch of idiots.
And I meant, Bahrain and Saudi Arabia are minding their own business, and now they are being bombed because of other people. Qatar and Abu Dhabi is in November, so, you know, to see how long the war lasts, because they are caught up in the same issues. But it'll, you know, save for those variables that are outside of everyone's control. It is your regulation calendar. Lot to look forward to.
The 24 races.
Just the 24. Three a month quite often now, which is kind of good. Not so many break weeks. Still have the mid-season break.
Yeah, a few triple headers.
Yeah. So yeah, that'll be good. I'm looking forward to that. Is there anything else to say about the Formula One upcoming season, or is it onto our standing order?
The only thing I would say is put your money where your mouth is. What are your predictions? Drivers champion, constructors champion.
Head says George for drivers, and I think if George is in a position to win, then I think that will be. George for the drivers, and I'm not gonna go Mercedes, because I think that Antonelli, whilst I think he's talented, probably not be consistent enough to bring home the bacon for Mercedes and the constructors.
I agree. Yeah.
Head says George. If it's not George, it will be Max, because that's just the order of things. Heart says the goat sails off into the sunset. 8 9, baby.
Gets out the car, retires on the spot.
Yeah. And then constructors, I am going Ferrari, I think. Little bit of heart overhead there. But driver lineup is what's selling that to me.
I think the buzz is more with Ferrari than McLaren. I think one of those two have the more complete driver lineup to win the constructors. Not that Antonelli's not good, of course, but he's learning. Mm-hmm. He is young. He is learning.
So yeah, that's for me. Are you aligned, or do you have a?
Aligned. I think George, and I think whoever does better at Ferrari and McLaren for the constructors, just about. But if Mercedes are as good as they threaten to be, then it won't matter. They'll just run away with it.
Yeah, yeah. Well,
it won't be Red Bull for the constructors, but it might be Max for the drivers.
We will know in 6 months' time.
Fair enough.
So yeah. Well, we'll still be doing this, so we can check back in and see how accurate we've been. Standing items, Jack. What
could it be?
Has Gianni been up to now? Is the cartel unrest going to add to the atmosphere in Mexico for the World Cup, do you think?
It would be a very strange thing to say if that was your angle of approach on the particular issue.
Let's give Gianni the benefit of the doubt then and say that he didn't say that, but he might be misquoted as saying something like that, because he was asked about that, the violence that's broken out in Mexico over the past few weeks after a cartel leader was killed. He has suggested that in light of the Prestiani scandal with the alleged racist abuse of Vinicius Jr. in the Champions League, that players should just be sent off for putting their hands over their mouths, which, you know, is really grasping the nettle of racism in football at FIFA.
Yeah, that's how to solve it.
Yeah.
Take a zero tolerance approach to players secretly communicating with one another.
Yeah, that'll...
It'll be interesting to see, actually, if that is to tackle racism, if that's his idea for tackling racism. I don't think it'll be implemented. I think he's just a bit of an old coot at this point with his ideas. But, like, you're going to end up sending off a lot of players of all different races and colours and religions and backgrounds for simply covering their mouths. The idea is to protect people.
Super idea.
I think there are far better ways you can do it.
Super idea.
Put a microphone in all the players' bloody socks.
I tell you what Gianni hasn't been up to, mate. He hasn't yet again found the time to comment on the recipient of his World Peace Award and say anything about Iran, which is weird, considering Iran have qualified for the World Cup, which apparently the cartel are going to make more exciting. So what is to be said? Venezuela, at least we could hide behind the fact that, like, it's not really got anything to do with football. So, you know, we can avoid commenting on it. But this one does actually have a tangential link to association football.
I mean, if one was cynical, one could possibly speculate that his dumb comments on players getting sent off for covering their mouths may or may not be a means of distracting from the fact that he doesn't want to talk about current world politics or be asked questions about Donald Trump. But that might just be me being a cynic.
How could you be that cynical, Jack?
I don't know. The world's just grinding me down, Ben.
You celebrated 10 years in office recently.
Jesus.
This is a man of integrity.
Have they ever heard of term limits? bloody stick a 4-year term limit on it.
Yeah, talking about cartels.
God.
Anyway.
There's something.
That's what Gianni's been up to. We've got a couple more Six Nations episodes coming out.
We do. Eventually.
Some of them might be out, but I don't know what our next big episode is on. Don't know if we've planned that yet.
I think we're just sort of playing this year by ear a little bit, to be honest.
Flying but by the seat of thy pants.
Seems to be working so far. No major catastrophes so far.
Not the most professional outfit here at the Almanac, but we do our very best just to keep enjoying ourselves.
What I would say is we're taking a very different approach to last year.
Yeah.
Where we had it all planned out months in advance, and now we're going easy. We're about to come back around on stuff we've already done anyway, so, you know.
Yeah. Consistency is the key. Cool. All right. Well, Formula One, enjoy it. Strap in. If you can be bothered to get up, get up. It will be on at like 4 a.m. over here, but they won't all be that unsociable in the Northern Hemisphere. And Australia, have fun.
It's a rite of passage, honestly. Like, I do not feel any issue whatsoever with getting up at the crack of dawn to watch the Australian Grand Prix to open the Formula One season. I can't wait.
It will be good fun. It will be good fun. And yeah, the people of Australia, enjoy the weekend.
Indeed.
See you in a bit then, mate.
See ya.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Thank you for joining us for our episode today. We appreciate you coming along for the ride. You can really help us out by dropping us a like, a subscribe, a comment or a share. But even better than that, tell a friend and spread the word. Our theme tune is Oh Yeah by Harmonia Productions. You can find us on Instagram and Blue Sky at The Sporting Almanac. If you've got any ideas for future episodes or any good stories you want to share, drop us an email at sportingalmanacpodcast@gmail.com. See you for the next one, and whether you're in pole position or struggling to make the checkered flag, don't forget, sport is nothing without the history that makes it. Goodbye.